It's August 18th, 2026, and you're listening to the Annals of Internal Medicine podcast. I'm Dr. Christine Lane, Annals Editor-in-Chief, and I'm here to give you a quick summary of the latest articles you'll find on annals.org. We hear a lot about surgery for osteoarthritis of the knee and hip, but not much about surgery for osteoarthritis of the big toe, also known as hallux rigidus. The first article I'll mention changes that. It reports a randomized trial that compared surgical fusion of the first metatarsophalangeal joint to watchful waiting for people affected by arthritis of this joint. Researchers from the University of Helsinki randomly assigned 90 adults aged 40 years or older with chronic symptomatic hallux rigidus to either undergo first MTP arthrodesis or continue with observation alone. After 12 months, patients who underwent surgery reported an average walking pain score of 1.3, compared with 5.7 among those in the watchful waiting group. A lower score indicates less pain with walking. Benefits were also observed among patients undergoing surgery for secondary outcomes, measuring pain, function, satisfaction, quality of life, and use of analgesics. The findings suggest arthrodesis provides a significantly greater reduction in walking-related pain and is an effective treatment option for painful hallux rigidus. Next is a report of an observational study that found that older adults with consistently elevated N-terminal pro-B type natriuretic peptide, or NT-pro-BNP, concentrations, a blood marker linked to heart stress, had a significantly higher risk for cardiovascular disease and death, while those whose elevated levels returned to normal had a risk similar to people who never showed signs of heart stress. Researchers analyzed data from 8,454 adults aged 70 years and older who had no history of cardiovascular disease and participated in the ASPRI, the Aspirin in Reducing Events in the Elderly trial, and its extension study. They measured NT-proBNP at study enrollment and again 3 years later, then grouped participants into one of four categories: persistently heart stress-free, meaning no elevated NT-proBNP at either visit; heart stress remission, meaning elevated at trial enrollment but not at year three; incident heart stress, not elevated at enrollment but elevated at year three; and sustained heart stress, elevated at both visits. Over a median follow-up of 8 years, participants with incident or sustained heart stress faced higher risk for cardiovascular disease and all-cause mortality, while those categorized in heart stress remission had comparable risk to those who remained heart stress-free. The findings suggest that monitoring longitudinal changes in NT-proBNP may improve assessment of cardiovascular mortality risk in older adults. In an accompanying editorial, Karen Alexander discusses how population-based research cohorts with asymptomatic older adults provide a unique opportunity to evaluate NT-proBNP prevalence and prognostic significance. She believes that NT-proBNP could become a valuable component of wellness testing in older adults, given its ability to identify low and potentially modifiable risk, while also providing a measure of biologic aging. Since all landmark randomized controlled trials comparing direct oral anticoagulants, or DOACs, and warfarin in patients with atrial fibrillation exclude those with moderate to severe mitral stenosis, current guidelines recommend warfarin for patients with atrial fibrillation and mitral stenosis. However, off-label use of DOACs may occur among patients with this condition in real-world settings. Clinical interest in using DOACs as alternatives to warfarin is growing, driven by warfarin's narrow therapeutic window, substantial interpatient dose-response variability, complex food-drug interactions, and the consequent need for regular international normalized ratio, or INR, monitoring. Another new article reports a trial emulation that evaluated the effectiveness and safety of DOACs versus warfarin in patients with atrial fibrillation and mitral stenosis, using population-wide insurance claims data from Taiwan. Compared with warfarin, DOACs were associated with an increased risk of stroke and a decreased risk of myocardial infarction. Rivaroxaban increased the risk of ischemic stroke during both short and long-term follow-up periods. There was no difference between the two groups in the risk of bleeding or all-cause death. The study is limited by sample size and lack of detailed information on mitral stenosis severity and INR measurements, but suggests that DOACs may be associated with an increased one-year risk of stroke, but a decreased risk of myocardial infarction compared with warfarin. Quality improvement is a routine part of healthcare delivery, but ineffective quality improvement can have unintended consequences, wasting resources, and paradoxically worsening healthcare quality. Randomized quality improvement trials use randomization to assign the intervention to some but not all patients or clinicians. These trials can provide strong evidence to healthcare leaders making decisions about whether to scale up, modify, or abandon a quality improvement intervention, but they are infrequently used due primarily to a lack of clarity about how regulations and ethical principles apply to these studies. A new Research Methods and Reporting article proposes a definition for randomized quality improvement trials and an approach to ethical oversight that is consistent with federal regulations. In a new Annals Beyond the Guidelines feature, a general internal medicine physician and a cardiologist discuss how to evaluate and manage perioperative cardiovascular risk in an older patient with multiple chronic conditions who's preparing for non-cardiac surgery. Using the 2024 American Heart Association American College of Cardiology guideline that emphasizes a stepwise patient-centered and team-based approach to perioperative cardiac assessment, the experts explore how clinicians can balance the need for preoperative testing with the risks of unnecessary procedures and surgical delays. Go to annals.org to watch the video of the Grand Rounds or read the article. You can earn CME and MOC credits if you do. The topic of this month's In the Clinic review is inflammatory bowel disease. Go to annals.org to update your knowledge on the care of patients with this condition and the dizzying array of new treatment options. And there's another option to earn CME and MOC credits. There are a number of new ideas and opinion commentaries. Topics include modernizing nosocomial infection surveillance methods, FDA's revised approach to assessing the comparative effectiveness of biosimilars, and patient-centered decision-making for adults with intellectual disabilities. There are also two new IM Matters news stories. One covers a novel series of American College of Physicians administered microgrants funding grassroots efforts to combat obesity via small projects across the country. Funds pilots that seek to educate patients and clinicians, create durable educational material in multiple languages, reduce stigma surrounding obesity and its care, and make use of existing resources. The second news article covers an expert consensus care pathway from the American College of Cardiology for the postpartum care of patients with or at risk for cardiovascular disease. Finally, a commentary by Aaron Carroll and David Atkins discusses the many ways that the Trump administration's cuts to the Agency of Healthcare Research and Quality threaten the future of healthcare quality and patient safety in the United States. They explain how recent staffing cuts, funding disruptions, and organizational changes affect AHRQ. They point out that the Trump administration's actions have led to the cancellation of at least 115 approved research projects, raising concerns about the future of research that helps improve patient safety, healthcare quality, and medical decision-making in the United States. Authors argue that the loss of AHRQ could have far-reaching consequences for clinicians and patients, by disrupting studies on diagnostic errors, maternal health, primary care, and other issues that no other federal agency is specifically tasked with addressing. They outline actions that Congress should take to mitigate these adverse consequences. That brings us to the end of this podcast. Go to annals.org for the new material I've mentioned here and more. Thanks for listening, and thanks to Beth Jenkinson, Andrew Langman, and Bernie Turner for their technical support.